Welcome to the podcast from Cambridge University Medical Education Group, or CUMEG for short. This is a podcast from the University of Cambridge School of Clinical Medicine, focusing on medical education. We'll be touching on a range of topics that medical educators are dealing with. I'm your host, Cheryl France, head of CUMEG. Today, I will be speaking with Dr. Vanessa Nash. Vanessa is the lead for clinical reasoning and communication skills at the University of Cambridge School of Clinical Medicine. So welcome, Vanessa. It's lovely to have you with us today.
Lovely to be here.
I think the best way to start out is for you to introduce yourself a bit more about what your role is, what your background is, and that way we can get a better understanding of what we'll be talking about today.
Of course. So I'm a GP by background. So that's a family physician. And I trained at the University of Cambridge, graduated in 2008, did my initial medical training and then my general practice training around Cambridge. As part of that, I did an academic clinical fellow year where I did an extra master's degree course, sort of looking at research methods. And sort of alongside that sort of medical training and my general practice training, I was working as a facilitator, running some of the small group teaching for the communication skills strand. So I've been involved in communication skills teaching first as student and then as a facilitator. And I've been facilitating for about 15 years probably. And then I've taken over the lead role just over a year ago. And that means that I'm now responsible for coordinating the kind of curriculum strand, if you like. So I do slightly less face-to-face teaching, slightly more coordination, and I do a day and a half a week of that working with the medical school to make sure that the communication skills training that we're delivering to the students is the best that it can be, and supporting that and tying it in with the other areas of the curriculum.
Wow, so quite a focused background here in Cambridge, which is good in terms of you being able to lead on that and having been the student here, having been in the hot seat and then taking it to help our upcoming students. So that kind of brings me on to the whole thing about the University of Cambridge kind of being a pioneer in earlier days of pulling together some of those methods used in communication skills from what's often referred to as the Cambridge-Calgary method. Can you kind of tell us about that history and how things have evolved since then?
Sure. So as you say, Cambridge is one of the leads in that area. It had Jonathan Silverman, who'd worked on it along with some other colleagues from the University of Calgary, hence the name. And it was one of the first sort of guides, I guess, to provide a structure for communication skills, with the idea that there are processes that actually, if you follow those processes through, it helps to create a structure to your interview. And actually what you need to do is to combine those process skills with the content that you're eliciting. And so it helps to give a toolkit, if you like, for students to use and to follow. And we still use that Cambridge-Calgary guide today, and that's what our students work from and look at. A lot of things, you know, do change, but actually a lot of essentials are still very much the same. So those sort of sections within it about introducing yourself, then initiating the interview, gathering information, further explanation and planning perhaps that might be needed, looking for cues, picking up on responses from your patient, how do you bring the interview to a close? And all the time you're thinking about the structure and relationship building that run all the way through your consultation. So those areas are still key, and that's still the structure that we use in terms of teaching our students here.
Okay. I mean, that's quite interesting, and there's a lot to it. And we're focusing today on the whole aspect of communication skills and how important that is. And I think sometimes individuals who are thinking of becoming a doctor may not recognize that you need to have that much in terms of communication skills, because it's about, oh, how smart am I? Can I do my biology and my anatomy? And can you tell us how big a part of this is in terms of being a doctor?
Yeah, so I think it's a key part, really. It's all about the consultation. And actually there's, within the Calgary-Cambridge guide, there's sort of 71 individual bits that it's broken down into, but actually the essence of it is what information do you need from your patient? and how do you best work with your patient to make sure that you've got all the information. And there's lots of evidence and research out there showing that if you go in straight away with a load of questions, boom, 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 then the risk is that you've gone down a rabbit hole and actually there may have been some other really vital information that might have led you to a different diagnosis, but the patient hasn't disclosed it because they haven't been given the opportunity. And also that you're, when you think about the efficiency of your consultation, you may only have a short period of time in which to take a history from a patient. You know, in general practice, we've got quite short consultations. So thinking about, well, how am I going to be efficient? And that may actually be by allowing the patient to talk first, by asking open questions, allowing you to gather as much information as possible. And we have certain, you know, sort of words that we talk about, like screening and signposting. But what that really means is sort of to screening. Is there anything else that right. you wanted to ask about? Any other thing else you've noticed? You might signpost to give the patient an idea of when you're going to move on. So there's sort of all of those bits mean that you can conduct an efficient and effective consultation, and you're hopefully getting all the information out that you can integrate then that content you've gathered with, you know, you've used your process skills to gather it, now you've got the content, which means at the end, actually, it's not just that you've had a nice chat with the patient and had a lovely time, that's all very well, but actually, what have you found out? How are you going to then think about what information you've got, use your reasoning skills to decide, well, what investigations might I do next? Or what might my management plan be? Or what might my management plan be that's going to be acceptable to this patient? Because you may have two patients presenting with the same symptoms, but your management plan may be very different depending on actually what that particular patient needs.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting. And that's where you're saying it's that clinical reasoning skills that have to come into play, because two patients might present the same, but it's completely different diagnosis for them.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a lot to kind of grasp and get into what could be a short conversation and really help that patient with the next steps. How do you go about this? Like, what does a typical training session look like or session with students to gain these skills?
So we try and work in small groups because actually it's a practical skill. You need to be having a go, trying it out. It's not something you can just learn from a textbook. You need to be practicing forming the words, practicing reading another person's emotions and putting that all together. So we run small group sessions. We'll generally have six students. We'll have one facilitator who is a clinician. So they can provide some role modelling. They also know what it's like on the wards or in surgery. They can give that input to the students to say why it's relevant, how it ties into the real life outside the classroom. And then we'll have a simulated patient who is trained on the roles that we're practicing in that session. Most of the sessions are sort of three and a half hour sessions with a break in the middle. So that gives time to start the session by establishing what people know about it. Actually, what have they done already? What have they seen on the wards? What information and knowledge are they coming to this session with? Making sure they've got the basics and discussing between us about what we think the challenges might be for this particular scenario. Then we have time for each student to have a go at a section of role play. That might be several different scenarios over the course of the whole half day session where they take a consultation.
Okay, so when you say you're preparing them, so do they know roughly what a patient's going to be presenting with?
So they'll be told the topic of that whole session.
Okay.
Now that might vary. So, but it, for some of the scenarios, they might be told it's a patient with this condition, or this patient has presented to the general practice saying they've got abdominal pain.
Okay.
Or they might not be told much at all. They might be told you are a medical student, as you are on the wards. You're just going to go and take a history from this patient, which is what they're doing in real life. So we try and mimic what their experiences are outside the classroom.
And is that based on where they are in their studies?
Exactly. And the idea is that we take students in Cambridge, they have three preclinical years where they do more science-based courses and lectures, and then they have 3 years at the clinical school. The graduate course is slightly different, and they have 4 years, and their first two are sort of interwoven, the equivalent of year four. But essentially, we do 3 years of clinical practice, and we take the students for their sessions during those. So in the first year of that, we start with the basics. So their first sessions are about initiating the interview. Actually, what do you need to say in your introduction to a patient? It might be different to meeting a friend down the pub. What do you need to say? Who are you? What are you doing there? What is your role? Making sure actually you practiced introducing yourself, which might sound simple, but actually it is quite key. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get that right, it can set the whole consultation off on a slightly difficult footing. So we start with the students with introductions. Then we start thinking about how do you start gathering the information? What information might you need in a medical history? And they'll have been learning that elsewhere as well. That kind of ties in. But we'll start with gathering information. And then we'll look at relationship building. Actually, what happens if some emotion comes into play? How would you deal with that? In the first year, we also cover interviewing an older patient because they may well have placements on the wards, particularly in medicine, where there's older patients that they're coming across. What other challenges might you have with multimorbidity, lots of medications? How do you get a medical history? Perhaps if somebody is getting distracted during your conversation with them, and how do you bring them back round to the topic you need to discuss in a timely manner? We also do an introduction to breaking bad news in that fourth year. And then as it goes on, for the fifth year, they're doing their specialties in hospitals. So we have sessions on sexual and reproductive health, psychiatry. What might be the ways that you might need to adapt your interview in certain situations? How might it be different if the patient is very embarrassed about talking to you, or if they're, you know, very depressed? What might you need to do differently? And so we then work on things like explanation planning, shared decision making, cycling around into year six, where they're building on all those skills that they've already gathered, but they're advancing them and taking them to a sort of more detailed level. So, for example, in year six, they have a whole 2-day course based around death and dying. And actually, they're getting to quite challenging scenarios there. For example, one of them is needing to tell a mother that her son has died in a road traffic accident. Mm. And that's a really difficult thing for anybody to have to do. But to be able to do it in a safe environment in a classroom where if you get your words a bit wrong, it doesn't matter. You can try it again. You can pause. You can time out. Someone else can have a go. You can take it into small snippets. You can say, well, what happens if the patient becomes defensive, if they become angry? What if they burst into tears on me? So we build all that in and build it up over the course of the 3 years so that they start with the taking a medical history, and then build that through to more specific scenarios.
Yeah, oh gosh, you gave me the chills with that. It must be really difficult. And I know that our death and dying course has been really well received from students throughout because it's given them confidence when they graduate and they are actually put in those positions. So I think that is something we've had a podcast in the past about how the importance of that. And I think that's it's good you've highlighted it again because for those medical students going out into the real world, it's important. But so is it just as important when you're dealing, like you said, with the elderly who may be confused about all the different pills that they're taking and what does that mean? To those that might be suffering from depression and crying throughout or not giving you any emotion, how do you deal with those scenarios? So it's tricky.
And those areas, particularly around some of the shared decision making and explanation and planning, sometimes could be overlooked. But actually, if you haven't worked with the patient to understand what their thoughts are, then you may, you know, the risk is that you come out of a consultation thinking a patient is understood it all, taken it all home, is going to start on their tablets, but actually they may not have understood why the tablets are important, so they might not take them. That might not have been something that's high priority for them, and therefore it's not something that's going to sort of continue after they've finished talking to you. So those skills about actually making the patient your first concern, actually you may have advice that you may give, or you may have an opinion, but actually that's not something that you force onto a patient. That needs to be a dialogue with the patient to find out more about what the patient thinks and to kind of come to a shared decision about management that the patient feels confident with and understands. And then that's sort of more of a, as I said, more of a dialogue rather than something that we're sort of enforcing on the patient.
Yeah, and that's so important. I was listening to a scenario recently where a patient was saying they had taken a certain medication that was prescribed to them and they understood they needed to take it every time they ate. But in actual fact, so they were doing it, but they snacked a lot. And actually, they were overdosing on this medication. Yeah. And it was through those conversations that the doctor went, oh, I don't think think you should be taking quite so many pills. Mm. But again, that just shows how important that dialogue is. And that patient just didn't realise from their first consultation to, I don't know how long they'd been on this, but it's that sort of thing that can happen so easily. So this is an example of where it's really important. Yeah.
And we know that a lot of the problems that can arise on the wards or in GP surgeries, a lot of the complaints that come through from patients, it's not just about the clinical care, it's about the way that was communicated. And so actually, if your communication skills are good, that's going to reduce a lot of complaints down the line, which is better for the patient, but also less stressful for the doctor. So it's thinking about actually, what am I hearing? How do I listen to what the patient's saying, as well as also what information am I providing and how do I provide that clearly?
And that is a skill. That's a huge skill. So I can see why these sessions are so important, because not only are you listening to what your patient's saying, but particularly as a young doctor, your mind's just going, what is it? How do I do this? How do I process what they've just told me to then say, I've got a diagnosis or I'm going to decide the management plan, next steps. It may not be a full diagnosis. It might be we need to explore more. But that is a huge skill to get.
Yeah. And it's why we have quite so many sessions on it. So I think we have about 300 students per year. And they will get sort of 5 or 6 sessions of this per year. I think we run in the department over 1,000 clinical reasoning and communication skills sessions every year across those 3 year groups. Wow. It's a massive amount of sessions, the logistics, having the facilitators and the simulator patients. But we do it because we think it's important. And actually, you need that training to go alongside the work they're doing on the wards, so that when the students are going out on the wards, they can feel confident that they've had a go at this, they practiced it, or that they might come on the wards, experience something that's a bit tricky, but come back to us and be able to say, hang on, I had a patient who said this, quite how do I manage that? Oh yes, I can see that this is a problem in real life. Yeah. I saw a doctor having a difficult consultation. I want to be able to feel confident when I go in that situation that I've got the tools to deal with it.
Yeah, and that's good. That's good that they have the confidence to come back and say that. I mean, you mentioned how many sessions you have. I mean, logistically, this sounds like a nightmare. What's the setup? So if somebody's saying, oh, we want to re-set up our suite, or, you know, we're not doing this, or maybe not to that level, what's involved in terms of staffing, rooms? What does it look like?
So I would say we have a pool of probably about 40 clinicians who facilitate. Some might do 6 sessions a year. Some might do 40 or 50 sessions a year. We then have a pool of simulated patients. So we have 2 people who work in the office helping coordinate them, work on bookings, and they work as self-employed freelancers, often actors by background, but they are then sort of almost auditioned and to check, because we don't want someone coming in to give a performance. It's not about them and how beautifully they've acted, you know. It's about actually how can they work to provide what the student needs. So they get calibration sessions to prepare them for the roles. So we have, you know, 2 team members in the office who work particularly with them. Then we have 3 other team members who help to coordinate the sessions and the booking. So when the students know their schedules, they're slotted in. Sometimes we might have 3 sessions running of the same session. Sometimes it might be up to 7 running at the same time. So we have sessions running most days of the week, slightly less on a Tuesday, but just because of the way the sessions fall out. If students are away on placements off around the region, then those sessions we try and schedule on a Monday or a Friday, so that they can be in Cambridge. They're not coming back to Cambridge in the middle of the week. And then obviously if they're in a placement in Cambridge, then there's a bit more flexibility. Those sessions then might be the ones we schedule.
Yeah. And I'll just explain for our audience who may not have heard how our setup is. So we have hospitals and GP practices or general practitioners that we use that are across the east of England. So our students are not only based in Cambridge, they travel up to, what is it, about an hour, isn't it, for some of the hospitals that they need to go to or GP surgery. So I think that's important to say. Logistics can be difficult. So how many physical rooms do you use, and are they kitted out differently?
Yeah.
What does that look like?
We've got several in the Deakin Centre, which is sort of more purpose-built. The rooms are kitted out with, so we've got six rooms in there. When we need more than that, or those are occasionally booked by the people for different things, we've got some rooms in the clinical school as well. So we've got about four rooms kitted out there. And the setup isn't massively complicated. You've got a row of six chairs in a semicircle. You've got one for the facilitator, one for the role player. The bit of extra kit that we do use is having a camera in there and a computer and a big screen on the wall to project it to. Because what we do is seat the person doing the consultation, doing the role play. They tend to go for maybe 4 or 5 minutes at a time. We don't let them run a whole consultation because you need to get through everybody and you need to be able to give them feedback on their performance. And that feedback needs to come from the other colleagues in the room, from the other students, from the facilitator and from the role player, because that's the key bit of giving the patient feedback. So you need enough room in the space in the room to fit those people in. And then we tend to have the student running the role play and the simulated patient will sit at a small table behind that circle so that the students aren't looking directly at them. But we have a camera set up on the wall that records them, and that then sort of projects that onto the screen at the front. So those students who are observing will look at the screen, not all sort of staring, you know, directly at the student. And that then means also that we capture that video and then can use that to replay snippets. Nobody likes watching loads of videos themselves. No. we try to keep it to a minimum, but actually it's got a really helpful educational benefit, because often you see things when you watch back on the video that you don't notice when you're in the thick of it. And sort of focusing on what am I saying, what's my next question. You might pick up bits of body language, particularly in the non-verbal communication. And so we use the video to replay small snippets, not to make the student feel bad. We try not to show the bit where they felt it all fell apart, but you might show the bit leading up to that to help them recreate that feeling and ask for help. Then what do I say when the patient tells me, you know, that they're worried they've got cancer and I didn't know how to answer and I froze. We might show the bit leading up to that and use that, or we might use it to show a positive and say, did you notice that when you explained clearly what was going to happen, the patient relaxed, and did you see their shoulders drop and their body language change? And we can show that on the video as a short snippet. We tend to then take the screen back off so they're not sitting looking at themselves.
Yes.
But it is a very useful educational tool.
Yeah. So I think that's good to say. So you can do it all in the same room, because I've seen other simulated situations where people might have a hospital ward kitted out and everybody's in the next room, a big scenario happens, and then you come back together. So it can be done in the same room. It can be done two different rooms. You can have different scenarios in which you set up. And I know we're also looking at some modern suites, which are going to be quite exciting but very technical. But I think it's useful to say you can go from less technical to having an all singing, all dancing room. Scenario.
Exactly. You could have, you know, big screens behind that make it look like you're in a ward or in a GP surgery, rather than sitting in a corner of a classroom. But it doesn't have to be that technical. I think it is helpful if you can not to have everybody staring at you, which is why we position it and then use the camera so they then it sort of makes it almost in a bubble for that student. And it's amazing how many students say, oh, well, it's not real life. It's, you know, I'm not on the ward, so it's not real. And then they have a go and they come out and say, oh my goodness, that I really felt like I was talking to that patient. And it becomes a conversation with those two people looking at each other. And that becomes the reality, not everybody else sitting in the room.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And also that students do feel that way, so that the training is as realistic as you can possibly feel in terms of that situation. So I think that is really good. So now kind of, I think we've kind of talked a bit about how do you get the communication going? How do you utilize that in your clinical reasoning skills? And also how much time is devoted to that. So I think that's really helpful. Are students actually assessed on this, or is it just, you know, fun?
So it's a big part of their assessment, actually. So the sort of other side of my role is that I'm responsible for the SCI exam, which is this sort of simulated clinical encounter examination, which they sit in the final year. And it's one of two practical exams that our final year students sit, and they have to pass both aspects in order to graduate If they were to fail one of those, they would have to resit their whole final year. So it's high stakes exam. The hope is by the time we get to that final year, we're confident that they've developed the skills. And in that, they'll have 7 different stations, each with a simulated patient. Some of them will be focused around the history taking, information gathering, and they'll have a short viva at the end. So as you're saying, integrating that that process and that content, and the mark grid is divided into process and content, and they're scored on both. So we look at how they do it and what they find out, and then they will have a viva to say, well, present this patient. Right. What is your thinking? What's your, you know, what are your top differentials? What's your management plan? What investigations would you need? And they'll kind of draw that on for sort of 3 of the scenarios that they have. They'll have another couple of scenarios where they're given a bit of information in advance. Go and talk to this patient has come in to talk to you about condition X. And that mimics what they would do on the wards, where if you were going to go and talk to a patient about something, you would make sure you'd done your reading, you knew what you were going to talk to them about. You might speak to a senior colleague. And those stations are really testing, well, how do they then do it? So you're looking at the explanation and planning. You're looking at the shared decision making. Can they explain this condition to a patient in a way that the patient understands? Can they work with the patient to understand what the patient's thoughts are, what the patient's preferences are? Can they come to a shared decision? So those, we're not testing the knowledge. Do they know what this condition is? That's tested elsewhere. What we're testing is, well, how do you communicate that?
Okay.
Which is a big part of what they'll be doing as a junior doctor. And then the other 2 stations tend to be what we call other stations. So they might be testing a different type of skill. They don't have a viva, so they have slightly longer to take the history. 10 minutes for a consultation for the ones with a viva, 14 for those where they don't have a viva. And it might be a slightly more complex conversation. So those tend to be testing the slightly more advanced skills, perhaps dealing with a patient's emotion, or dealing with an end-of-life scenario, something where actually you would need a bit more time.
Okay.
And so testing, what do you do when you come up against a consultation that perhaps is a bit more tricky for whatever reason? So that's tested in there too.
And so that's why it's really important to have what you call simulated patients or actors who really understand and can be consistent, so that it's fair in terms of...
Absolutely. And our simulated patients are some of our greatest resource, really. They're really what makes the session really effective, because when they're in the standard sessions and when they've had a go at the consultation, it's the one bit you can't do on the wards is ask the patient, how did that feel for you? did I come across as empathetic? Were there other concerns you had that you haven't shared with me? You can't ask that to a patient, but you can to a simulated patient. So our simulated patients are given all of the background information there. They're not given a script, they're not reading a role, but they are given the information to enable them to know how to respond. So how might I respond if this student is quite empathetic and gives me time to talk and you feel comfortable with them, then you might go on to disclose this information. And we calibrate that all. And for exams, it's a similar process, but even more carefully calibrated, because you need to make sure that the way that the student on the 4th day is getting the same rigor and also the same experience in their exam as somebody on the 1st day. Now, it's very difficult because every student will be different. Every consultation will be different. The words will be different. And you can't, as I said, you can't give an exact script because you don't know what that student is going to say. So what we do is work carefully with our simulated patients to calibrate a range of possible ways and to give certain bits that will be kind of perhaps given very easily, that the patient would be likely to say straight away, and to think about, well, what other information is there to make sure they really know their details? What medication are they on? What's their family history? All those bits that the patient would know.
Yeah.
But also that they can then make sure that they're giving an equal opportunity to every student coming in. And that's the benefit of a simulated patient as opposed to somebody who isn't trained in that.
Yeah, that makes sense and helpful for the student to know it's going to be fair, because the end of the day, that's their biggest panic.
Exactly. and we kind of calibrate that quite carefully prior to the exam. And we also, during the exams, we have some of our sort of expert simulator patients will listen in on certain bits, even as the day goes on, to check outside the exam station. Am I hearing everything right? Are there any concerns? You know, is this all running as it should?
Oh, that's good. So there are lots of checks and balances in place. And as you say, it's a high stakes time for the students. And, you know, we want them to succeed. It's not about setting them up to fail in any way. Like you said, it's about having all these sessions in advance so that when they get there.
And it's in their exams in year four and year five as well. So it's not coming as a shock in year six. Yep. So year four, they have five stations, you know, based around it. In year five, they particularly have exams focusing on obstetrics and gynecology and on pediatrics. But within that, they will have a couple of stations that are more communication skills stations as part of that. So it's built in throughout the course and it's assessed throughout the course too.
Okay. Oh, that's good to know. So, I mean, this podcast might be heard from people from around the world who may not already do something like this or may think, oh, maybe we should do things slightly differently or set things up differently. Would you have any advice to say, you know, if we were starting from scratch, these sorts of things we would just make sure are always in place?
So I think just start with the basics. So think about the history taking. Think about you know, how you start the consultation. Make sure that the students are confident with the basics. There's obviously, you know, a myriad of different sessions that you could add in that would be great for the students to have practice on, but it may be that actually you don't have the capacity to do all of those to start with. So thinking about you know, how they take a history, maybe how they deal with emotions. Perhaps are there particular areas that are a problem in terms of the feedback from your junior doctors that are coming through where they felt underprepared? So one of our sessions that we run is called Communication Challenges for Foundation Doctors, and we do some telephone consults, and they ring and they need to take some information from a nurse on a night shift, and then they need to ring and they need to speak to a registrar and try and get the registrar to come and help them. And then they need to explain to a relative that a patient's deteriorating and needs to go to a high dependency unit. Then they need to explain to the patient that they've made a mistake with their errors. So all of these bits are built on real life experiences of junior doctors who've come to said, this is, you know, this is hard.
Yeah.
How do we do this? So, you know, perhaps look at what are your juniors struggling with, or what are you noticing in terms of areas of skills to develop? For us, we have the sort of GMC outcomes of a doctor, which sets out what they expect students to be able to do by the time they finish medical school, what skills do they expected to have, and that acts as a guide as well. So there may be similar bits in different countries that set out what the expectations are that could also be used as a guide for what we should be teaching.
Yeah, that's really useful, and useful to say it's about taking that time to go back potentially to those who have recently graduated to say, where did you feel some pitfalls are? What else could we learn from? And I think that was really useful for you to say, the telephone conversation. And now we do a lot more video consultations and different types of consultation. Is that something that's touched on in the course at all?
Yeah, so one of that same session where we do the telephone, one of them we also do is a face-to-face, but on the video. And we talk to students about, well, what extra information might you need if you're phoning somebody? They do a tutorial in year four and year six where they do a whole consultation recorded on Zoom, and they speak to a simulated patient. And we talk about, well, how do you check who else is in the room? Are they available to talk? What else might you need to talk to them about in terms of the tech? What will happen if it doesn't work? So we talk to them about that, and for those sessions, and they run a whole consultation, and then they have a tutorial just with two students and one facilitator online later, going through that whole recording bit by bit. So that's the only one where they watch the whole thing, but we only have it with two students, and we really dissect it and take it down so that they can get that really individualized feedback. And I think that's one of the real strengths, is that you can give that individualized feedback, that sometimes if you're on the wards, so it's possible you can become a bit anonymous. No one's really looking at what you're doing and how you're doing it, and give you new suggestions for improvement.
And also in a safe environment. I think that's really useful to say too, because it sounds quite intimidating. And I think, oh gosh, you know, to have to watch a video back. But if you're in a safe environment where we're looking at the positives and how things can improve, it must be a bit easier.
Yeah, and we always really emphasize that to us as students. So this is a safe space for you to practice, for you to have a go. You're not going to upset our simulated patients. You know, you're not going to say something that's going to harm them. You're not going to give them false information. You can pause, you can time out, and we always re-rehearse. That's the other kind of key bit of sort of educational practice, that once they've had a go, we have a discussion and we get feedback from everybody in terms of what they noticed, what they saw, making sure that's descriptive and not judgmental, not, oh, that was great, or that was rubbish. Why? What did you see? What did you notice? What happened when? And then the students can have another go at a snippet, 30 seconds, usually a phrase or a very small bit, that they want to just try something different. And we always try to make sure that that's a positive learning bit, so that you come out feeling like you've achieved something, but also you've changed something and you've got something you can take with you that's going to be different for when you go forward.
Yeah, which is really helpful. Yeah. Oh, this has been amazing. thank you so much. I think it's good to hear that all this training does happen, and you do see it. You know, if you are in a hospital setting or at a GP practice as a patient, you do see the introductions, the questioning, and you know, some people go, oh, why are they asking me this? Thinking it might be, oh, they don't know what they're talking about, but it's not at all what it's about. It's about a structure that is helpful so you can really learn what's going on from a patient. So that's really helpful for us to hear more about today, and also how you would set that up in a medical school and what that could look like. We've talked about a lot. Do you have three takeaways from today that you'd say these would be the top tips?
Yeah. I guess the first bit is to think about what your outcomes are. So, you know, for us, for the students, we're thinking about sort of GMC outcomes of a doctor. And making sure you've got the training behind it. We're really careful about how we train our facilitators so that they run through a whole training program before they start solo facilitating, so that we know that the students are supported in that and that the outcomes that we're getting match with what they're meant to be learning. We don't want that one student has a rogue facilitator who's teaching something different. So the training and for the facilitators and for the simulated patients, to make sure that the outcomes we're achieving are those that the General Medical Council wants.
Yeah.
And we're hitting all the curriculum targets.
Yeah, and that's really important. Sorry, it just made me think of something, because I know some medical schools, you know, it is expensive to have simulated patients utilize their own students to sit in the hot seat, as it were, as the patient and others having to do the questioning. And that's perfectly understandable, because it is expensive to have these simulated patients. Are there any tips that you would give if that's the scenario?
I think you just need to calibrate it as much as you can.
Yeah.
So obviously there's a benefit to not knowing what's coming, because often when a patient comes in to speak to you, you don't know what their background is. So not having everybody read the brief, that perhaps the half who are reading it haven't told the other half, and then you swap over different scenarios. Where possible, it's trying to make sure that it's as neutral as possible. They're not doing it as themselves, they're not bringing any beefs they might have outside the classroom into that, and that you, where possible, you build the scenario as much as possible so that they've got all the information at their fingertips.
Yeah, okay.
To build it, and I think then that kind of leads on then to kind of the other bits that I would consider in terms of important bits, would be that it is the benefit for the student. And actually, it's the whole point is the learning experience for the student, that they've got that safe space to practice, that they get the direct feedback from the patient. How did you feel? What happened when? And that they can try those things that they haven't done in real life, because most people haven't told somebody that their son has died. Most people haven't had to speak to someone about intimate sexual details. So that you practice those things that are difficult, are hard, and that you've had a go where there aren't any big consequences.
Yes.
You can try it again. And I think then that leads on to then the benefits for the patients, is that then overall what we're trying to do in medical school is to create, you know, excellent doctors who will go on to give the best patient care. And so if we can train your students and give them the support with the communication skills side of things, then your outcomes for your patients down the line are going to be much better. And when you look at the sort of referrals to the General Medical Council or the complaints that come in, often it does have an element around the communication. So if you can improve things for your students in terms of their skills and their competence, that's got to improve patient care as well.
Absolutely. Thank you. This has been an amazing session. I've really enjoyed speaking to you today. So Dr. Vanessa Nash, thank you so much for your time today and helping us to understand more about clinical reasoning skills and communication skills and why those link so closely and the importance of it.
No problem at all.
Thank you. If listeners are interested in learning more, please contact us via the QMEG website. You will also find our previous podcasts on the website at www.cumeg.cim.ac.uk, or look for us wherever you get your podcasts. We are grateful to you, our listeners. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to listen to us today. If you'd like to hear more from this and our next series or any of our previous podcasts, please like and subscribe to our podcast. Until next time, I'm your host, Cheryl France. Thank you again for listening.